Hi, this is Andrew Phillips. Thank you for downloading the Graymere Church of Christ Sermon Podcast. If you have any questions or if you'd like to contact us, check out our website at graymere.com. We'd also love for you to visit with us in a worship service. You're always welcome at the Graymere Church of Christ.
Thank you for joining us for our Sunday night sermon time. About a year ago, my family and I were able to watch a magician, and I always think it's neat to see illusions that magicians perform. I always try to figure out how they're doing it, and I'm always impressed when people have perfected their craft in such a way that it's hard to tell what's happening. One of the things we picked up afterwards in the gift shop was one of these books. It looks just like a regular coloring book, but there's a little magic trick involved. When you start opening the book, you might get a little discouraged because you find out there's only blank pages. You paid for a coloring book, after all. And so you might be discouraged about that until you try it again and you realize, oh, there actually are some pictures here that I can look at. Well, that's pretty good. But the only problem is if you open it one more time, you find out they've already actually been colored in, and so there's nothing left for you to do. Now, obviously, this is one of those things you can pick up in a gift shop or order online, kind of an easy magic trick. But one thing you notice when you watch magic tricks is often the trick itself, the process of the illusion, is just as entertaining as the end result. So, for example, sometimes a magician might get halfway into a trick and then pretend like it's not working or pretend like there's something that's going wrong. And then there's this second step that you have to do, or even a third step, trying to fake out the audience and get ahead of their expectations. And so it's interesting to see the way those who do magic tricks and illusions have found to sort of subvert your expectations. You think one thing's happening and then something else happens. One of the things we've noticed as we've looked at our series of Jesus through the eyes of various people is that when Jesus is performing miracles, there's so much more than what we might think of as an illusion or some kind of magic trick. It's not that Jesus is trying to get publicity by being able to do something powerful. He's showing us something very significant. And the reason that's important to keep in mind is because we're going to look at a couple of miracles that Jesus performs in Scripture. They're both healing of those who are blind, but they both happen sort of in stages, in a sense. The first time, he puts some clay in a man's eyes and then gives him specific instructions, and the healing happens after those instructions. The second time, he heals the man where he's able to see partially, but not able to see fully. And sometimes people might think, well, maybe this is just part of the process. Somehow, you know, Jesus is wanting to impress people, and maybe it's a step-by-step kind of illusion, but I don't think that's the case at all. In fact, when Jesus heals people, we've seen time and time again, he has the power to heal people instantaneously, to do it from a distance. He doesn't have to be in the room. After all, he is the Son of God, God made flesh. So when we look at these couple of miracles, I'd like for us to see the deeper meaning behind why Jesus would choose to do it this way. If Jesus chooses for there to be miracles that happen in one or two phases, then there's obviously a reason why. And so I'd like for us to spend some time thinking about that, looking at Jesus through the eyes of those who had been blind. And there are a couple of groups in these miracles who are watching the miracles, and we realize they're having a hard time seeing as well. Not physically, but they're not able to see the spiritual point. So the first is in John chapter 9. I'm going to read the first few verses of the chapter, but it's really helpful to read the whole thing to get the context of what happens to this man after this healing. But I'm going to start reading in verse 1. As he passed by, meaning Jesus, he saw a man blind from birth. And his disciples asked him, "Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he would be born blind?" Jesus answered, "It was neither that this man sinned nor his parents, but it was so that the works of God might be displayed in him. We must work the works of him who sent me as long as it is day. Night is coming when no one can work. While I am in the world, I am the light of the world." When he had said this, he spat on the ground and made clay of the spittle and applied the clay to his eyes and said to him, "Go wash in the pool of Siloam," which is translated sent. So he went away and washed and came back seeing. Therefore, the neighbors and those who had previously saw him as a beggar were saying, "Is not this the one who used to sit and beg?" Others were saying, "No, this is he." And still others were saying, "No, but he is like him." He kept saying, "I am the one." So they were saying to him, "How then were your eyes opened?" He answered, "The man who is called Jesus made clay and anointed my eyes and said to me, 'Go to Siloam and wash.' So I went away and washed, and I received sight." They said to him, "Where is he?" He said, "I do not know." They brought to the Pharisees the man who was formerly blind. Now it was a Sabbath on the day when Jesus made the clay and opened his eyes. Then the Pharisees also were asking him again how he received the sight. And he said to them, "He applied clay to my eyes, and I washed, and I see." Therefore some of the Pharisees were saying, "This man is not from God, because he does not keep the Sabbath." But others were saying, "How can a man who is a sinner perform such signs?" And there was a division among them. So they said to the blind man again, "What do you say about him, since he opened your eyes?" And he said, "He is a prophet." Well, let's pause right here. We're going to see how the formerly blind man progresses in his understanding. But let's think a little bit about what actually happens when they encounter this man who had been blind from birth. What's the first question that the apostles ask? The first question isn't, "Well, how could we help someone who is blind from birth?" The first question is, who sinned? Who's responsible for this? Even though we might not articulate it the same way today, we typically look for people who are responsible. When something bad happens, we often look for who should be blamed. And in the first century, it was a live discussion among Jewish teachers and rabbis as to what sin caused in the lives of others. It's a theory of retribution that we see both in the Old and New Testaments, the idea that if someone is suffering, it must be as a result of sin. And so they saw a man who's born blind, and they said, "Well, this has to be a result of sin. Was it his sin or his parents' sin?" Now, it seems strange to us that someone could have been born a certain way because they sinned. That would sort of imply you were sinning before you were born. But you can see why this debate would have been really controversial and something that people talked about a lot, especially in the first century and even today. How many times do we hear people say, "What have I done to deserve this?" Right? We have this instinct that we should be getting what we deserve, and if we get something bad, it must be because we did something wrong. And I think the contrast here between their attitude and Jesus' attitude is remarkable. First of all, he tells them they're asking the wrong question. It's not a result of either sin. So he says, neither one sinned, right? Not all suffering is a result of sin. Yes, sin causes some suffering, but not every bit of suffering is a result of sin. What he says is we have the opportunity to do good, to shine the light, to do the deeds of the one who sent me. So maybe it's a good reminder for us that before we start looking around for someone to blame, when something goes wrong, maybe we should look for a way that we can do good. Which would be more valuable? Jesus says it's more valuable to do good. And so he does something that's kind of strange. He spits on the ground, applies clay to the eyes of the blind man, and tells him to wash in the pool of Siloam. Now, the pool of Siloam was a famous landmark in the southeastern part of the city. It was built by King Hezekiah, a pipeline that carried water from outside Jerusalem. So the name means sent, as the text tells us, and he's sent there. Now remember, this would not have been the easiest task for a man who was blind to make his way to the pool of Siloam. He actually had to take action. He had to take action based on faith, and he had to do what the one he had faith in told him to do in order to receive this healing. Now, why would Jesus choose to heal him this way when he healed other blind people immediately? I don't know that the text tells us exactly why, but I think there are a couple of things we can learn from it. Number one, it gives us a great example of what it means to actually take action on what we're commanded by God. Walking to the pool of Siloam didn't somehow count as an achievement for him where he earned his sight, but it was the only way he could have his sight was to do what Jesus had said. It also may be that it's important in Jesus' plan for this, for the man to be by himself when people start asking questions, and they do start asking questions. You can imagine, if you're used to seeing someone who is blind and who is begging, and now he's walking around and can see, it would be hard to figure out, is this really the same person? Have you ever seen someone in a different context than you're used to seeing them, and you have to think, is that really who it is? Like when you were growing up, the first time you saw your teacher in a grocery store, and you were thinking, this, you're not supposed to be here. This is not where you are. It's kind of hard to make that connection. And so we can imagine the confusion. And so he's finally brought before Pharisees. And the Pharisees start focusing on the fact that it was the Sabbath. Again, I think it's worth noting, we've seen it in these miracles. They don't deny that the miracles happened. They don't tell this man he was never blind. They try to figure out a way that it happened that would somehow contradict the will of God. Now, by this time, there were a lot of man-made laws around the Sabbath day. Scholars tell us there were 39 categories of, quote, work that could not be done on the Sabbath, including tasks as simple as braiding hair. That was too much to be done on the Sabbath. And so they're trying to figure out, all right, exactly how did this happen? When they find out it's on a Sabbath, then they start saying, well, he can't be from God or he wouldn't have broken our Sabbath tradition. Notice it's not that he wouldn't have kept the Sabbath, but he wouldn't have broken our Sabbath tradition. And so we see that this man is not the only person who's blind here. He's telling them that Jesus, in verse 17, he says, is a prophet, and the Jews refuse to believe it. So what they do next is they question this man's parents. And they ask him in verse 19, they ask the parents, how does he now see? And the parents say, well, we know this is our son. We know he was born blind, but we don't know how he sees. He's old enough. Ask him. So thanks, Mom and Dad. You're a big help. You're just sort of abandoning him to say, I don't know, he's old enough, ask him. He can stand up for himself. Now, why would they do that? Because they could already see the writing on the wall. The Pharisees were not happy with the way things were going. And in the community of the first century, your community identity was very important. Being able to worship in the synagogue would have been very important. You would not want to be cast out of the synagogue. And later on in John's gospel in chapter 16, Jesus warns the apostles that they'll be cast out of synagogues, that there'll be some exclusion. And we find out later in church history that that's what happens, that there is excommunication often for Christians, those who believe in Jesus. And so already here we see people afraid of that. And so his parents say that in verse 22 because they were afraid of being put out of the synagogue. And so the second time they go to the man who was born blind, he started off believing he was a prophet. And notice that when they respond to this blind man and they say, we don't know where he came from, he says in verse 30, well, here's an amazing thing. You do not know where he is from, and yet he opened my eyes. In other words, you can't figure out where he's from. All I can tell you is what he's done for me. If this man were not from God, he could do nothing. So now that he believes he's a prophet from God, then they say, okay, you were born in sin, right? You've been blind since birth. There's that retribution theory again. Let's get him out of here. So Jesus goes and finds the man. And as he talks to him, he reveals he is the Son of Man. He's the Messiah. And the man in verse 38 believes, started out knowing he was a prophet. I think he's from God. And by the end of the chapter, he believes Jesus is the Messiah. So the Pharisees heard these things at the end of the chapter, and they come up to Jesus and say, well, we're not blind too, are we? Jesus said to them, if you were blind, you would have no sin. But since you say we see, your sin remains. You see, the Pharisees couldn't see what was right in front of them. They couldn't see their own sin. They were very concerned with this man's sin. They were very concerned with what his parents might say, because if anyone said they believed in Jesus, they'd be cast out of the synagogue. But they didn't see their own sin. It was right in front of them the whole time. Now, they should have been able to recognize the Messiah when he came. They should have been able to see in Jesus, in his miraculous power, the hallmarks of the Son of God. But one of the reasons that they weren't able to is because they weren't looking clearly at even their own sin in their lives. He said, I wouldn't say you were blind, except you say you can see. It's one thing to have sin and to acknowledge it. Then I'm dealing with it. But if I have sin and say everything's fine, and I'm ignoring the problem, that's real blindness. They were blind to their own sin. It's really easy for us to focus on the sins of other people than our own. It's really easy for us to diagnose issues in the lives of other people instead of looking into our own hearts and our own souls and seeing what we need to deal with personally. You know, when you were growing up, if you got in trouble and you tried to blame it on someone else, what would your parents say? What would your teacher say? Right? You take responsibility. You don't just say this is so-and-so's fault. You take responsibility for what you've done. It's an important lesson for children. It's something we need to remember as adults. Because what it's easy for us to do is to say, well, what about so-and-so? What about that sin over there? What about this person? And as we do that, I am voluntarily choosing blindness. I'm turning a blind eye to my own sin that I need to deal with. Jesus tells the Pharisees that's not the way to do it. What the Pharisees could not see was their own sin. I need to ask myself if I have any blind spots in my life where I'm not looking at sin that needs to be addressed. It's challenging. And yet there's another example of a group that can't see, but this time it's not the Pharisees, this time it's the apostles. And when we get to Mark's gospel, in Mark chapter 8, it's a very quick exchange that we see, a miracle that only takes up a few verses, but I think it's significant. I'm going to start reading in verse 22. And they came to Bethsaida, and they brought a blind man to Jesus and implored him to touch him. Taking the blind man by the hand, he brought him out of the village, and after spitting on his eyes and laying his hands on him, he asked him, "Do you see anything?" And he looked up and said, "I see men, for I see them like trees walking around." Then again he laid his hands on his eyes, and he looked intently and was restored and began to see everything clearly. And he sent him to his home, saying, "Do not even enter the village." Now this seems odd, because Jesus does some things that maybe don't surprise us, using, again, spit or saliva in the eyes of a blind man, that would not have been as out of place in the first century as we might think it is today. There were often times that saliva was described as having some medicinal kinds of purposes, and so that wouldn't have been totally out of line. But then, when he heals his blindness, he can see, but not quite. So what does that mean? Does it mean that maybe there's some kind of like a power failure about halfway through and Jesus had to get it twice to get his sight fully restored? You know, years ago, the Holland Sentinel ran a report on the recovery of a man named Michael May, who had lost his sight in a chemical explosion at the age of 3.5. But after 43 years, he had surgery that allowed him to restore his sight, and they had been doing tests over a period of a few years after that surgery. He could see things in the distance. He could identify shapes and colors. He could determine objects in motion. But because he'd gone without sight for 43 years, there were some things his brain wasn't accustomed to interpreting. And so he had a hard time with seeing things in three dimensions. He would describe a cube as a square with some lines floating in front of it. He had a hard time telling differences between faces, even faces of his wife and children, by their face alone. He had a hard time with recognition. He had a hard time seeing the difference between men and women in their faces. He'd had decades of life where his brain was not accustomed to interpreting how these images work. Is that what happened here? Did somehow Jesus have enough power the first miracle to sort of heal the eyesight, but then the second miracle had to heal the way his brain interpreted things? I think as we look at Jesus' power and what we've already established, we would conclude not that Jesus had some kind of power failure, but there's a purpose for the reason he did things the way that he did. And I think that's significant for us to read. And by the way, the story of Michael May also reminds us about how incredible these miracles are. That it's not just recovering a certain area of the eye or being able to see differently. When Jesus heals someone, when he heals a paralyzed man, he doesn't just give him the ability to walk. He heals all the muscles that would have been atrophied so that he can walk. When he heals blindness, he doesn't just heal someone's eyes. He heals their brains in a way that they can interpret what's being seen. I think it's significant to consider why this is right here in the gospel. Remember, when Mark is recording this by inspiration, he also arranges things in a specific way. When you get to Mark 8, you're about halfway through the gospel of Mark. And many scholars say you could take part 1 and part 2, and part 1 sort of ends with what happens later in the chapter when Peter confesses that Jesus is the Christ, and then the rest of the book is following up. Now that we know that's the mission, here's what happens next. What happens here is that this takes place in the middle of a time the apostles weren't seeing things clearly. And what they weren't seeing clearly was their own mission. Now look at what happens just before this. If you go up a few verses, you find out that they're getting in a boat. He's been frustrated that people are looking for signs. They're in the boat with him. And the apostles get worried because no one brought bread. They only had one loaf of bread. No one brought extra for them. And Jesus looks at them and says, do you still not understand? When I fed the 5,000, how many baskets did we have left over? They say 12. When I fed the 4,000, how many baskets were left over? 7. In other words, the lack of physical bread is not the biggest issue they could be worried about, but they were still struggling to understand it. And so then Jesus heals this man, and at first he can see things sort of like trees walking around. It's fuzzy. And then he heals him again where he can see everything clearly. Then notice what happens next. Right after that is when Peter makes the confession. Jesus says, "Who do men say that I am?" He says, "You are the Christ." And then he began to teach them in verse 31 that the Son of Man, the Christ, must suffer many things, must be delivered over, killed, and rise again. And then Peter said, "No, that's never going to happen." He rebuked Jesus. He made the confession that Jesus is the Son of God. He could see, but it was still really fuzzy, wasn't it? He still really couldn't understand what really needed to happen. So we get to the end of the first half of Mark, and we see the apostles are at a point where they can see, but it's still a little fuzzy. They don't understand exactly what being the Son of Man entails. In fact, Mark chapters 8 and 9 and 10 show this over and over and over again. So in Mark 8, Peter rebukes Jesus for saying he's going to suffer many things. So then Jesus summons his disciples and says, "If you want to follow me, you need to take up your cross." And a cross not only indicated pain, but it would have indicated shame. In other words, that's where I'm headed. If you want to follow me, you have to take up your cross. In Mark 9, Jesus again tries to clear things up for them. They still see things in a fuzzy way, and he's trying to clear it up. And he says he's going to suffer through the cross. Verse 32 of chapter 9 says they didn't understand him, and they were too afraid to ask him anything. And maybe after seeing what he said to Peter, I can understand that reaction. But shortly after that, they get into an argument over who's going to be the greatest. Can you see they're still missing the point? It's still fuzzy. They don't understand what Jesus is saying. Then you get to chapter 10, and the third time, Jesus says, here's what's going to happen. Here's how I'm going to be handed over. Here's how I'm going to suffer. And then right after that, James and John ask for places on the right and the left hand of Jesus when he comes in his glory. It was still fuzzy to them. They still didn't understand. I think the reason Mark includes this specific miracle where he does is as a picture of what was happening in the lives of the apostles. They were hearing Jesus. They were beginning to see the plans of God, and it was still a little fuzzy, and they didn't quite understand it. And it's going to be until later they can really see clearly. And so halfway through Mark's gospel, we get something that really happened, but also that functions as a picture, a physical picture of what's taking place spiritually. So what does that mean for us? It means I have to ask if I really see my mission clearly, because it's easy to lose focus. It's easy to let things get kind of fuzzy and glazed over. The only way I can understand my mission is if I understand what Jesus' mission was. And when we go through life, there are a lot of different people, a lot of different places that want to hand us missions to organize our lives around. They want to give us ways to live. Hey, if you're looking for how to organize your life, you can find all kinds of people who will tell you how to live your life and what to eat and what to do and how to work out. And I'm not saying those things are bad, but I'm saying if I don't have my own agency to decide, I've got to choose how I'm going to live my life. People will decide that for me. And so what I need to do when I look at Jesus' mission is say, have I decided I'm going to fulfill my mission? And my mission might not look the way I want it to. Jesus' mission didn't look the way Peter thought it should. James and John sitting at the right and left hand of Jesus didn't end up the way they thought it would end up. So I don't need to be surprised when life goes differently than I had planned, and when I think that I might be going one way, but following Jesus leads me another way. I also need to be incredibly determined to keep anything else from taking over God's mission for my life. I need to be ruthless with my priorities and to make sure that nothing else begins to guide my life, that I'm not so wrapped up in any other aspect of life that I lose sight of my mission. The apostles couldn't see their mission. They could only understand it if they could understand Jesus. So here are a couple of times we see Jesus through the eyes of those who had been blind, and looking from their perspective tells us something powerful. In John chapter 9, we see a man that once he followed Jesus' commands, received something incredibly life-changing. And as he did that, he continued to learn and continued to grow and understand Jesus was the Messiah. In Mark chapter 8, we see a man who knows what it's like to see things partially, but then to see things clearly. I need to take a look at my life. Is there sin that needs to be addressed? And do I understand a mission? Is there something I'm missing when it comes to living out my mission? And the great thing about studying God's word is that we're not left with those open-ended questions and then no strategy to deal with them. We have an opportunity. If there's sin that needs to be addressed in life, if I've never become a child of God, then the way to address that sin is to turn my life over to him, to put Christ on in baptism. If I have made that decision, then the way to deal with that sin is to go to God in prayer. And both of those avenues are open. If you're interested in finding out more about becoming a Christian or being baptized, please let us know. Contact us at the church building, find our website, send us an email. We want to talk with you about that. If there's sin that requires prayer and counsel and wise advice, contact one of our elders. They want to get to know what's happening in your life in ways that they can encourage you. And if maybe we've lost sight of our mission, this would be a good time, a good week, to renew our efforts to serve God. Let's be sure this week that we walk through life looking for what we need to be looking for, focused where we need to focus, and that we go through this week living for God.